It's Thursday, June 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams reporting from Washington. Coming up, the European Union says more violence is likely in eastern Ukraine. We speak with the writer of the open letter that calls on China's Communist Party leaders to be held accountable for the Tiananmen Square crackdown 26 years ago today.
I believe it is my responsibility as a citizen, since history has been covered up and revised in China, and a lot of us would never have the opportunity to learn in detail what had happened.
And we hear the latest about U.S. rapper Kanye West. It's all ahead. The European Union says renewed fighting in eastern Ukraine is the most serious breach of the ceasefire that was agreed to in February by the warring sides. Each side blamed the other for Wednesday's violence, which Ukrainian officials say began near Donetsk when about 1,000 pro-Russian rebel fighters launched a pre-dawn attack just west of the city. VOA's Jeffrey Young speaks with Keir Giles, associate fellow at Chatham House in London, about Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko's statement that there are 9,000 Russian troops in eastern Ukraine, and warned the country must be on alert for a large-scale attack.
Mr. Giles, in your view, is Mr. Poroshenko putting out rhetoric or is he ringing a fire bell?
Well, President Poroshenko knows perfectly well that if he cries wolf too often, people will stop paying attention. So you have to assume that there is some genuine concern behind what seems to be a warning of an imminent attack. And of course, what he's saying is backed up by the sightings of the OSCE monitoring mission in eastern Ukraine, which have seen Russian heavy weaponry moving towards the front line. You have to assume also that U.S. and NATO intelligence is keeping a close eye on what's happening, but of course they're constrained in what they can release about what they're observing.
We have been looking for several months at the possibility of Russia possibly extending itself toward Crimea and establishing a land bridge. Do you think that there's a possibility that this buildup could be in that direction?
There is always a possibility. However, we have to remember that throughout the duration of this conflict, Russia has been able to achieve many of its objectives without actually taking more Ukrainian territory. There are a number of other tools which Russia is using to achieve what it wants. This morning, my organization, Chatham House, put out a report called The Russia Challenge, in which we outline some of the ways in which Russia is achieving what it wants without necessarily needing to take territory. So, yes, there are scenarios which include a further land grab by Russia, but it need not necessarily happen.
On the other side of the chessboard, what can the West and others do in response to the Russian initiative, if indeed it is an initiative? More sanctions?
Obviously, there will be no direct intervention, but it is essential to extend sanctions and to keep them up, because the sanctions are intended to have a long-term effect on the Russian economy and Russian leadership. Over and above that, there is direct support being made to the Ukrainian defense forces in terms of capacity building, training, some limited supplies of equipment. Those are having a positive effect in the ability of Ukrainian army to withstand Russian assaults.
Keir Giles is an associate fellow of the Russia-Eurasia program at Chatham House in London. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
Thanks very much, Jeffrey. Well, today, June 4th, marks the 26th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown in Beijing. Recently, an open letter was issued by a group of Chinese students abroad to their peers in mainland China. The letter was circulated on social media and through emails. It focuses on the crackdown and calls on the government to confront its actions that day. University of Georgia graduate student Gu Yi wrote the letter, which was co-signed by 10 other Chinese students in the U.S., Britain, and Australia. The state-run Global Times newspaper denounced the letter. I spoke with Gu from his Georgia campus. You wrote this online letter. It's sort of like become a petition. How did this come about? How did you decide to do that?
Well, and before I came here in 2012, I actually had got some access to a little bit of information of what had happened in my country 26 years ago, and I was determined to learn more. So after I came here, I got full access to a lot of blog information, including pictures, video clips, and documentaries, and then newspaper reports, which revealed what a disastrous and brutal event had happened. And I was determined to tell my peer, to tell my fellow students back home of this guilt and of this crime, of this tragedy in history. I believe it is my responsibility as a citizen, since history has been covered up and revised in China. And a lot of us would never have the opportunity to learn in detail what had happened. So since I live in the United States and I have the chance to write such an open letter to raise awareness and concerns so that we do not forget the history and we can continue our pursuit for justice.
How much do Chinese students, say people that are your contemporaries, know about the events that took place at Tiananmen Square?
I have to say most of the students know a little bit, to a very small extent, as June the 4th has actually been incorporated in textbooks, which says there were some political incidents in 1989 and the party and the government took firm measures to stop that incident to maintain the stability of the country. So that is all they can know from history textbooks. I don't deny that many youngsters like me are able to climb over the wall to get some blocked information, but what they get is kind of a monotony, and a lot of them are unidentified, and they also have to resist the official explanation which blames the students as responsible for all the bloodshed. So this is rather a complicated question, and I realize that a lot of students, I don't know how, what's the proportion, a lot of them actually know what has happened, but they just, some of them are apathetic, and some of them are just too afraid, and you know, any open discussion about June the 4th is strictly forbidden in China.
And the reaction to this letter, well, there has been negative reaction from the Chinese government, but what kind of reaction have you received from other Chinese students, those that are abroad, but those that might be in mainland China, if they're able to know about this?
Well, after the Global Times and editorial, we received a lot of new signatures alongside with mails to my email address. But I have to say that most of these feedbacks were quite positive, and people have shown their support and sympathy for our move and deep understanding of history and responsibility. On the other hand, I also realized that such feedbacks are not overall. First, people choose to write me letters and sign their names. It's kind of a filtering, an automatic filtering, so that they are positive before taking this reaction. Second, I also received a few negative remarks, even including some threatening messages, most of them in Chinese. So what I can say is that I did receive a lot of warm reactions and a lot of encouraging feedbacks, but that's not all the story.
So at the moment, I guess this means, though, because of this letter, the online letter, you probably have difficulty if you want to return to mainland China.
And we're pretty much certain of that. And just as we have written in this letter, that everyone, including the author and the co-signers, are fully aware of what consequence to follow this letter. But what's more important is that you can't let this constant fear, the fear of out of human nature, to overcome you before you take any actions. We are doing something right. And we believe that you have to take some risk before doing something right.
I thank you very much, Yi, for speaking with me today. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Gui, the primary author of an open letter to Chinese students about the Tiananmen crackdown, which occurred 26 years ago today. Well, we've got two articles about the Tiananmen crackdown on our website today, and Michael Lippin joins me in the studio to tell me about them and what people are saying about the anniversary online. Michael?
Thanks, Sarah. Well, one of those reports that you mentioned is from Shannon Van Sant. It's titled Hong Kong Vigil Held on Tiananmen Anniversary. And in that article, we hear from Hong Kong politics professor Joseph Cheng, who explains why many young Hong Kongers who weren't even alive in 1989 still feel so strongly about the crackdown. The other article is by William Gallo. It's headlined, Chinese Students in U.S. Urge Justice for Tiananmen Massacre. In that story, we learn more about Gu Yi, whom you just spoke to, and the other Chinese college students who wrote that open letter to China's communist leaders. Gallo's story also has details about how Chinese state-run media and internet censors responded to that letter. Now, the article by William Gallo also drew a comment from one of our readers. Regula in the U.S. strongly criticized the Chinese students, saying their letter is a product of U.S. brainwashing and interference in Chinese internal affairs. That reader also said that the authors of the letter don't have much to learn from the U.S. about democracy because the U.S. hasn't solved the problem of police brutality against minorities, for example. Now, that kind of criticism of the U.S. and Chinese pro-democracy activists, you know, that they're being brainwashed and so on, is similar to what we typically hear from the Chinese government itself. Mm-hmm. Now, I've also been looking at how the Tiananmen anniversary is being marked on Twitter. The hashtag June 4 has been one of the more popular ways to mark the occasion, and that's been tweeted more than 3,000 times in the past day, according to analytics website Topsy. One of those tweets with the hashtag is from CNN international anchor Christy Lu Stout, who's based in Hong Kong. I actually worked with her once upon a time. Christy Lu Stout wrote that Hong Kong is the only Chinese territory where the commemoration of June 4 is allowed. Now, Topsy also says that the word Tiananmen has been mentioned 18,000 times in the past 24 hours on Twitter. Sarah?
Wow, that's amazing. Thanks very much, Michael. That's Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo. An international group of health experts recommends that if you want to prevent the onset of some serious chronic diseases and possibly premature death, you really shouldn't be sitting around for long periods of time, but instead get up on your feet and move around. The health experts poured through and analyzed previously gathered evidence concerning the dangers of prolonged sitting and have come up with a set of guidelines for office workers and others who tend to spend most of their day sitting. The group recommends that office workers should get up on their feet for at least 2 hours every workday. But the researchers also caution that standing for too long in one position may be as harmful as prolonged sitting. So instead of just standing still, move around a bit. The group's recommendations were just published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. And that's your Science in a Minute.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear the latest music from Kanye West. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush will formally enter the race for the 2016 Republican presidential nomination on June 15th at a rally in Miami. Bush sent a Twitter message Thursday with the headline "Coming Soon" over a picture of him looking away from the camera. The photo contained the caption "Coming 6/15/15" along with a link to his website. Now, another candidate is former Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who announced his candidacy Thursday in Dallas. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone joins me to talk about U.S. presidential politics. Well, Jim, there's a lot of political activity going on. The race for the presidency doesn't happen until November of next year, but at the moment it's getting very, very active. There's an announcement today.
In fact, former Texas Governor Rick Perry has decided to make a second run for the White House. He tried 4 years ago. His campaign somewhat imploded, especially during a debate when he forgot one of the government departments he wanted to eliminate. But Rick Perry's entrance into the race on the Republican side would make 10 officially declared Republican candidates. And we expect more to come in the weeks ahead, including former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, probably by the middle of this month. Jeb Bush has been seen as a leading contender, but the polls of late show sort of three Republicans bunched at the top of the polls: Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who is sort of a Bush ally in the past, and former Governor Bush. They're sort of at the top, but a lot of other Republicans are not that far behind in the polls, so that's a wide-open race right now.
Why are there so many running, though? Because a lot of these people, they're not going to be serious contenders, really.
Right. I mean, a couple of reasons. First of all, I think Republicans see the nomination as wide open at this point. So there's no reason not to get in. Maybe lightning, you catch it in a bottle. Maybe you can build on that. It's happened in the past. There's no sort of Mitt Romney-type figure who is sort of expecting his or her turn as the nominee. And so that's led to quite a variety of contenders. And the Republican Party is split up into a lot of different factions: conservatives, foreign policy hawks, Tea Party, social conservatives. That allows various candidates to kind of pick a building block and try to use that to gain momentum in the primaries and caucuses early next year. Certainly, a lot of people have been looking at Jeb Bush's fundraising prowess, which is impressive. But on the other hand, a lot of people are saying he's just not caught fire yet. And I think part of the calculations on the Bush campaign is maybe to move up that announcement, to get in the race now, see if he can restart the fire about his possible candidacy.
Well, the other two leading candidates in the Republican race that you mentioned, because certainly Bush is a very well-known name and connections and fundraising abilities from his family, but Senator Rubio as well as Governor Walker, why have those two gone further in the race so far?
Both have made good impressions early at various candidate forums around the country, especially with conservatives. Rubio places a lot of emphasis on foreign policy. It's become a huge issue, by the way, in this early stage of the campaign. A lot of focus on ISIL, the threat from the Islamic State, Rubio and several others taking a very strong stand on that, wanting a more aggressive campaign. But then you get someone like Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who got a lot of attention during the recent Patriot Act debate in the Senate, taking a different view, wanting to keep the country out of foreign wars. So that'll be an active debate on the Republican side. Walker's an interesting character. He gained a lot of national attention. He took on unions in his home state of Wisconsin, has a lot of strong followers among conservatives, someone they believe a governor who's done well, who won re-election and now could appeal to a wider swath of voters. But he is untested, and that's what this primary process is all about, and we're going to see that roll out now for more than a year.
Well, and looking at the Democrats, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is no doubt the front runner, but you also have Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, as well as former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley are running, and I believe as well former Rhode Island Senator Lincoln Chafee has also announced. Do these Democrats, other than Hillary Clinton, stand much of a chance?
A lot of the experts say no at this point, but they will note that Hillary Clinton's approval ratings, especially on issues like trust, personal accountability and responsibility, have come down a bit through the various sort of controversies we've seen reported on in recent months, the email, the Benghazi attacks, and so forth. But no, the challengers we're looking at, Lincoln Chafee, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, none of them has a national following. It doesn't mean someone can't catch on. And right now, there's probably a lot of buzz about Sanders, who's older than Hillary Clinton, makes her look younger, which I'm sure the Clinton people don't mind. But this sort of self-described socialist Democrat with this focus on income inequality, which has become an issue in the country, I think he's likely to get some buzz among progressives, the very liberal portions of the Democratic Party. They take on a bigger role in the primary process. They're the ones who tend to come out and vote. So in that sense, Sanders could try to appeal to them. But Hillary Clinton still looks very strong in terms of just winning the nomination right now. But there's going to be some debate there, and she will have to defend her policies. She will have to come out front and be more aggressive. And some of them, like Lincoln Chafee, are actually focusing on her foreign policy record. Chafee was the only Republican in the Senate to vote against the authorization of the Iraq War. So it's an interesting sort of foundation for his campaign. And again, we will have debates on the Democratic side, and Hillary Clinton will be put to the test.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
You bet.
That's Jim Malone. Singer Kanye West is in the news again, and not just for his music. VOA's David Byrd and Larry London fill us in.
Controversy is a word that is often associated with rapper Kanye West, from grabbing Taylor Swift's trophy at the Video Music Awards to disappearing in a shower of sparks on television at the Billboard Music Awards to his ever-present presence with his wife, Kim Kardashian. Well, Kanye has a new tune out now, and to talk about that and other things from Kanye's universe, I'm joined by Larry London. Larry, welcome.
Oh, thank you, David. Yes, Kanye West has a new album. It's called Swish, which is his seventh album.
And it's a studio album.
It's a studio album filled with a variety of performers he recorded with Taylor Swift. They patched up their differences. He recorded with Paul McCartney and quite a few other artists make guest appearances on the new album.
Now, is that a smart move on his part? It's kind of getting the great names to come on board with him?
Absolutely. It's a great PR move, especially at a time where he probably needs a little positive PR. He's caused a lot of, shall we say, negative reaction on his own for his own behavior, showing up 3 hours late to concerts and things like that. But but he's turning things around. In fact, I mean, he's got to watch himself a little bit. He gave a commencement address recently at the Los Angeles Trade Technical College.
Right.
And he mentioned, usually when you're the absolute best, you get hated on the most.
Oh, okay.
So trying to redeem himself and at the same time a little foot in mouth.
Well, you know, Kanye is known for his, shall we say, high confidence, high sense of self. Now, he's also about to be a father for the second time.
That's right. His little beautiful baby, Northwest, is about to have a sibling. Kim Kardashian announced this past week that she is pregnant with her second child due in December.
Now, has Kanye expressed an opinion about Caitlyn Jenner?
No, I haven't heard anything about Caitlyn Jenner. I haven't heard him. He stays low when it comes to the Kardashian family. He doesn't really speak out, certainly not negatively, because he knows what's best for him. He wants to keep the peace at home. So he just talks very positively about the Kardashian family and keeping up with the Kardashians, the TV show, and all that's going on in their world. But he doesn't talk about Caitlyn.
He hasn't spoken about that.
Not yet.
Somehow I don't think that Kanye will be left out of the mix, as it were. So his new tune is called All Day. What is this? Tell me about the genesis of this tune.
Well, it's in typical Kanye fashion. He's got all kinds of technical effects going on, which, you know, kind of mask his real vocals. But Kanye's had an interesting story throughout his life. There was a time when he got into a car accident. He almost lost his life. His mouth was wired shut for a period of time, and he's battled his way back. He lost his mom and done a number of things to pay tribute to her. But this particular song is an actual homage to his own life and a day in his life. So it could be any day. His last album, you know, Yeezus, was kind of an interesting approach to music. But this approach is a little softer. A little softer Kanye than we're used to seeing.
Okay, well, let's take a listen. This is Kanye West and his new single, All Day. Larry, thank you for being with us. You can also check out Larry's show, Border Crossings. You can find a link to it on our website, www.voanews.com.
All day.
That's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
All day. How long you... Ball, all day. How much time you spent at the mall?
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As African leaders continue working to end the political crisis in Burundi, the United States again calls on President Pierre Nkurunziza to respect the term limit provision of the Arusha Agreement in order to restore stability and help his country heal after weeks of violence. With his controversial candidacy threatening to undermine Burundi's economic and democratic progress, the president must consider how his attempt to retain power will affect the future of his country and his legacy. East African leaders from Tanzania, Uganda, and Kenya, along with South African President Jacob Zuma, met May 31st in Tanzania to discuss the crisis, following an earlier summit on May 13th. They called for the postponement of elections by at least a month and a half to create the right conditions for voting, as well as disarming the ruling party's youth militias. Protests erupted in Burundi in late April in response to Nkurunziza's decision to run for another term in June 26 polls. Opponents say that violates the Constitution and the Arusha Agreement that was key to ending a deadly 13-year civil war. The United States government's position remains that the Arusha Agreement must be respected and that any violation of Arusha seriously undermines Burundi's stability. The conditions for free, fair, transparent, and credible elections do not currently exist due to the closure of political space, the shutting down of independent media, the government's violent response to political protests, and continuing reports of violence and intimidation by armed youth militia. These policies are not in accord with the principles of a democratic country, especially one facing national elections. The United States calls for restraint by all Burundian stakeholders and regional partners. We urge all parties to continue to support the ongoing peaceful efforts to find a solution that is in accord with the Arusha Agreement, and to refrain from any acts that could contribute to the climate of instability or undermine the rule of law in Burundi.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.